For WKU Public Radio, this is Dan Modlin. A small secret group of anywhere from 250 to 400 Civil War soldiers weren't what they seemed to be. They were soldiers, all right, who fought and died on the battlefield, but they were women disguised as men. As our series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War continues during this Women's History Month, Joe Corcoran speaks with WKU military historian Dr. Jack Thacker and WKU Civil War historian Dr. Glenn LaFantasy about women on the front lines.
Well, it was a different time in which, in some cases, boys as young as 12, sometimes as young as 10, entered the service as drummer boys. So the fact that these women disguised themselves, they would actually have to bind certain parts of their anatomy to flatten certain things, cut their hair short, if they happen to have more masculine-looking features, then they could readily pass.
And the why of it, I imagine, is the same reason men fought in the war.
Not necessarily. Basically, three reasons are given in that. One is they wanted to be with loved ones. One was in the Confederacy. Her husband was a captain of a unit, and she was the second in command. And when he dies, she takes over. She's known as Captain Billy, and fights through much of the Civil War until they discover who she is. Then, secondly, they got better pay. It was male private in the Army made more money than you could make in the factory work. And some wanted a better life. And then third, some of them just wanted the adventure.
Well, there's a fourth, too, and that's patriotism. Yeah. And examples like Clara Barton, who turned out to serve in a different capacity in the war, her first inclination was to join as a disguised woman and to serve as a man. Her father had been a veteran of the War of 1812. She had grown up on his knee listening to war stories, and she felt that this cause of saving the Union was worth shedding blood over, and including her own blood. But she then later considered what the difficulties might be of actually disguising, of living as a man among other men, and felt that there must be some other way that she could serve. And, of course, she so famously discovered that and became one of the most famous nurses in American history and in the Civil War.
Going out to found the Red Cross. Now, not all women, that's a great point, not all women who served in the armies of either side back then were actually in it for the combat.
One woman who was on Lee's staff who was disguised as a woman. If they found out about her, and Lee kept her on his staff as a clerk in the on it, because she was wanted to be with her husband.
Some of these instances are really interesting, like the case of Albert Cashier, who successfully served in the 95th Illinois Infantry Regiment from 1862 through the end of the war. She kept her male identity after the war, and it wasn't until she grew extremely old and was getting frail and sick that she was in a veteran's home, and it was discovered that she was a woman. So she had lived practically most of her life as a man.
Dr. Thacker, there's another famous story of another
Mary Ann Pittman was served as a in the Confederate Army. She was a lieutenant under Nathan Bedford Forrest, and Forrest was operating in the area of the West and needed supplies and also information. So he decided to send Lieutenant Rowley into St. Louis to get it. So to get the information, Mary Ann Pittman, disguised as Lieutenant Rowley, disguised herself again as Molly Hayes and went into St. Louis and was very good at disguising herself as a woman and was able to gain supplies for the Confederacy.
So a woman disguised as a man, disguised as a woman, got the job done.
That's right. Absolutely.
And you know, speaking of getting the job done, the women who fought in the war on both sides, Did many distinguish themselves as far as in battle?
A large number of them were promoted. Not a single woman who disguised herself as a man was ever cited for cowardice or dereliction of duty. One interesting one, a young black girl served in the 8th New York Cavalry, and she was disguised herself as a white man, and she was able, she distinguished herself so much that she was sent to the War Department with 17, along with several others, with 17 Confederate flags to present to the War Department. So that's a very high commendation.
How big a secret was this during the war itself?
It wasn't a secret. I mean, the newspapers found out. Every time the newspapers found out about it, it became a big front page thing, and they couldn't get enough of that. Also, there were two novels written during the war. In the South, called Chastain, which was about a woman seeking revenge, so she disguised herself as a man. In the North, there was one called The Lady Lieutenant. And so that was well known. And then one memoir came out, Nurse and Spy in the Union Army, came out in 1864, and it sold 175,000 copies, which was a lot in those days.
So it was pretty well known up until about the turn of the 20th century, and then it started fading away from public memory and not emphasized in the histories until the rise of women's studies and women's history after the 1960s, 1970s brought more attention back to these actual women disguised as men soldiers. So now, 150 years after the Civil War, there's a growing public recognition of these women who served in a military capacity on both sides, in the same fashion that there was a public awareness at the time that this kind of thing was going on.
If their true identity was discovered in the ranks, they were treated well by their fellow soldiers?
They were discharged. Supposedly, the soldiers didn't know. They had suspicions.
It could be the best kept secret of a company or a regiment. And I've seen soldier accounts that are wry in their reference to Corporal Jones and Sergeant Smith seem to be extremely fond of one another because they go off during encampment. They don't sleep near the fire like the rest of us, but they seem to provide body warmth to one another. Yeah. And so from those kinds of hints that are not direct, one gets the sense that the soldiers may have been fully aware of what was going on, winked an eye at it, and just went on with being soldiers.
One of the official discharges from of a woman who had been discovered stated under the area under occupation, lady. That was the case. Now, in fact, and to show you though that how well kept these secrets were, at least 10 women were discovered when they gave birth to a baby, which was proof that they must be women.
WKU Civil War historians Dr. Jack Thacker and Dr. Glenn LaFantasy. Next week, as our Women in the Civil War series continues, the role women played in saving lives on the battlefield as nurses. That report can be heard next Monday, March 12th, during Morning Edition. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Dan Modlin. Almost from the first skirmishes and battles of the Civil War, the number of casualties was overwhelming. 21,000 in the Battle of Richmond alone. After the Battle of Chickamauga, hospitals and homes were filled from Chattanooga to Atlanta. The large number of survivors is credited to women stepping up and volunteering as nurses. As our series on women in the Civil War continues during this Women's History Month, Joe Corcoran speaks with WKU military historian Dr. Jack Thacker and WKU Civil War historian Dr. Glenn LaFantasy about ordinary women leaving their towns and farms to fill extraordinary roles.
One of the new things was the fact that women served in large numbers as nurses. Over 4,000 paid female nurses in the Union Army. We don't have the records for the Confederacy. But obviously huge numbers of Confederate women served as nurses also. For instance, after the battle, seven-day battles, and especially the Battle of Malvern Hill, there were 21,000 wounded in Richmond. And it covered all the hospitals, almost every house in the area, and women, huge numbers of women came out and nursed them. And so there was and if you look at the records from the Battle of Chickamauga, for instance, the aftermath of that two-day battle in September 19 and 20 in 1863, you have every hospital from Chattanooga to Atlanta filled, and huge numbers of wounded brought back by rail to Atlanta and put in private homes and nursed by women. So, and I think one of the things that made a big difference goes back to the Crimean War and Florence Nightingale, who became one of the great heroes of the Crimean War, being a nurse to the troops. And this made it socially acceptable for women to be nurses, which had not been the case prior to this time.
You mentioned about the Battle of Chickamauga and all the wounded. I see that scene in Gone with the Wind where the camera just slowly pulls out of all the wounded just laying on the ground. And
yeah, it's only inaccuracy is probably there aren't enough soldiers lying on the ground.
Yeah.
And what would happen after a battle, or in that case the siege of Atlanta, is that women, and this is portrayed actually in Gone with the Wind, women even like Scholar O'Hara, a selfish young woman, did become volunteer nurses. So after a battle, people in a very wide radius, whether this battle was Gettysburg in Pennsylvania or Chickamauga in Georgia, women would come to the battlefield and volunteer their services. And they might only serve in the aftermath of that particular battle, but nevertheless, this was something that Americans on both sides and women on both sides thought it was their duty to do, and also recognized that this was one way that they could serve their respective countries.
And let me make a point, too, and this is very important. If you go back to the Napoleonic Wars, or you go even to the Crimean War, if you were you had a much greater chance of dying if you were wounded than you did in the Civil War. That the women's much of the women's service, and especially in the area of cleanliness and that sort of thing, which was what Florence Nightingale basically, what Florence Nightingale was doing was basically the work of an orderly rather than a nurse, what we would call today. But in the Civil War battle, it was the Crimean War was fought between 1854 and 1856. Yet in the Civil War from 1861 to 65, death rate from somebody wounded was half as much.
Even in that little 10-year span.
Even that 10-year span. Yeah. And that part of it, I think, was due to the fact they got much better nursing care, partially due to that part.
Well, I was going to say, these women volunteering to be nurses or getting involved, did they realize what they were getting into? That's not easy duty.
No.
probably not. No. In most cases, they did not. Certainly someone like Louisa May Alcott, who volunteered and went from Massachusetts to Washington to serve as a nurse, she admits fully in her famous book, Hospital Sketches, that this was a very rude awakening for her. And it wasn't just the Victorian sensibilities, obviously, of seeing a male naked, but of course the maimed and disfigured men that had to be treated was just a horrible scene. Without the kind of medical techniques and knowledge that we have today, so that while they were probably performing such things as triage, they didn't know about triage, and had to do it anyway. I mean, those kinds of things were a real shock to many women. To their credit, these 4,000 that we know served as Union nurses, and an unknown number, probably close to equal number in the Confederacy. To their credit, many of these women simply stood up, passed the test, and did their jobs and did them for fairly long periods of time. Louise May Alcott did not remain a nurse. She got ill and had to be taken home. But in other instances, many of these nurses, under the direction of Dorothea Dix, and two organizations in the union, the U.S. Sanitary Commission and the U.S. Christian Commission, also provided nurses, because female nurses in the military was a new thing, and even having a medical corps in the Army was a relatively new thing. So all of this had to be invented as they went along, and it proved to be a vital aspect of the Civil War.
There's one ironic thing that happened on the same day, April 19th, 1861, when Clara Barton, who was working in the patent office, looked outside and saw the 6th Massachusetts Regiment, which had gone through Baltimore and been severely attacked by the pro-Southern crowd in Baltimore, and a lot of them hurt and everything, and got very upset, went out and brought them into her home and began to nurse them, and that began her career. On that same day, Dorothea Dix, who had already established a reputation in the medical profession, had gone to the White House to volunteer her services. So the two most famous women in the Northern Civil War, for the North in the Civil War, they started their service the same day.
WKU Civil War historians Dr. Glenn LaFantasy and Dr. Jack Thacker. Next Monday, in the third part of our series of reports on women in the Civil War, women by necessity filling new roles in factories, on the farm, and in the home. That report can be heard next Monday at 5:50 a.m. and 7:50 a.m. Central Time during Morning Edition here on WKU Public Radio. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Dan Modlin. During the Civil War, while hundreds of thousands of men went off to fight, their wives, daughters, sisters, and mothers had it every bit as hard staying home. Joe Corcoran concludes his three-part series on women of the Civil War during this Women's History Month, looking at the new roles women had to take on, roles still being felt today, speaking with WKU Civil War historians Dr. Jack Thacker and Dr. Glenn LaFantasy.
And it was difficult. The farmer's wife, with her husband gone, and a very good possibility that her sons had gone to war as well, the women left behind on the farm had to take over, keep the farm going, begin doing tasks that normally were the domain of men, and the domain of women in the period before the Civil War was inside the household. It was the woman's job to raise the children, to take care of the home. The male worked outside the home, the husband, the brother, the sons. And so women now found themselves in an entirely different sphere of activity that was required of them.
Well, now, one thing did help. That is, in a lot of light industry, we had already begun to mechanize. The Industrial Revolution had already started. So in a lot of the light industry, women were able to do some of those jobs, in textile mills.
Mechanization also had already changed agriculture, at least in the North. The McCormick Reaper had been developed already, and there were mechanized threshers available. But it doesn't take away from how hard a job farming was then, and these women had to do it. They didn't especially like it after a while. Historians have shown that in the first stages of the Civil War, where patriotism was at its height in the Union or in the Confederacy, women willingly sent their men off to war to do their patriotic duty, to defend the country, and were fully supportive patriotically of that effort. But as the war wore on in both sections, then attitudes began to change. And their letters take a turn. Generally speaking, letters from wives and mothers to soldiers begin very enthusiastically to support the war and then later say, why can't you just come home? And in some instances, families sent two soldiers, husbands, brothers, sons, civilian sets of clothes. And this was meant as a temptation for desertion. Why don't you come home?
Well, there's also a tendency sometimes, especially in the Southern armies, that toward the end of the campaigning seasons, or September, October, November, they did go home, and you know, like it came back in the spring in terms of it. But it, if you take a look at the number, the casualty numbers after the Battle of Chattanooga, November 20th, 1863, there's a huge number of, quote, missing from the Confederate Army after their defeat at Chattanooga. So, indications are a large number did go home.
Yeah. In the South, especially if a family was, you know, well off enough to have slaves, were women, one, comfortable now in running the household, ordering the slaves, and did the slaves obey the woman of the house as they did the man?
It became very difficult because slave society was structured on a patriarchal organizational hierarchy, and males were at the top. You remove the males from the top, the women attempted to assume those duties but felt enormously uncomfortable because dealing with the slaves, ordering the slaves to do things or punishing the slaves for disobedience had always been a male activity. And here were these women who now were confronted with very new challenges, including psychological challenges, of readjusting to this new world. It also changed attitudes, their attitudes toward the war effort itself. Similar dynamic going on in the North, though, is that just the hope that these men could come home and assume their rightful place, except for the women who experience a breakthrough of their own, and a breakthrough in the history of gender and the history of gender relations. And that is people like Dorothea Dix and Clara Barton, other nurses less known, not famous, had been put in a new situation in which they had proven themselves as being capable. They were in work situations. They had dealt with matters of authority, management, conducting their own job duties responsibly and efficiently. This gave women a new sense of themselves, and scholars attribute the rise of the feminist movement, which had begun in the North in the late 1840s, an outgrowth of abolitionism. Well, it's spurred on by these women who become very knowledgeable, very capable, and see themselves now in a very different way, not always as dependents to males, as subordinates to males, but people who could function on their own in a male society.
So in a very real way, both in the North and the South, did we see a social change toward a more matriarchal society even when the men came home when the war was over?
Not instantaneously, and not really to a great degree. Patriarchy would still exist with men as the head of the household. There was some resentment among women industry workers, like happened in almost every war, that when the war is over, the men come home and take their jobs away from them. Here are women who had finally become wage earners in one way or another, and now the men, the returning soldiers, are displacing them. What happened in the South is interesting, is that much of women's efforts after the war in the South, in the former Confederate states, moved away from the services of providing nursing or philanthropic services like preparing what we would call care packages to send off to the soldiers. You knit some socks or you send them some candy or an apple pie. It moved away from that kind of activity during the war to remembrance of the soldiers and their courage after the war. And, of course, the United Daughters of the Confederacy is probably the most famous of these women's groups that has long survived since the Civil War. That experience, however, in the South with organizations like the United Daughters of the Confederacy also instilled in women a slightly greater sense of independence, to the point where historians do acknowledge that the UDC contributed a fairly good number of vital members to the women's suffrage movement later in the early 20th century. So here are Southern women that at first are protected, standing on a pedestal before the Civil War and then in the South somewhat through the Civil War. But by the time the 20th century comes, some of those same women are now in the forefront of saying it's about time that we got the vote in this country. In the North, there's a similar kind of transition among these new assertive women who have found a rather new identity for themselves, not just as mothers and wives, not just the maternal roles, but now roles that they could actively pursue in the public sphere outside the home.
WKU Civil War historians Dr. Glenn LaFantasy and Dr. Jack Thacker. In case you missed one of the reports in this series or would like to hear them again, go to our website at WKYUFM.org and click on Civil War Series under Categories at the bottom of the page. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Dan Modlin.